banded together from remote galaxies are 13 of the most sinister villains of all time, the Legion of Doom, dedicated to a single objective, the conquest of the universe. Only one group dares to challenge this intergalactic threat, the Super Friends. The Justice League of America versus the Legion of Doom. This is the Challenge of the Super Friends.
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence. Started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the areas. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. One long conversation with a variety of guests about the best in popular culture. Our topic this week is superheroes in novels and beyond, part 3. And our guest to continue what has been one of our more popular topics is Ian Thomas Healy. How are you doing, Ian?
I'm doing just fine, Van.
Well, I'm very happy to have you aboard. Let me introduce Ian a little bit. Ian is a prolific writer who dabbles in many different speculative genres. He's a 9-time participant and winner of National Novel Writing Month. I did that once, one time many years ago, where he's tackled such diverse subjects as sentient alien farts. We'll leave that one to you to explain later. Competitive forklift racing, that sounds awesome. A religion-powered rabbit-themed superhero, fascinating. Cyberpunk mercenaries, cowboy elves, and an unlikely combination of vampires with minor league hockey. That is like the best resume I've ever seen. I just have to insert there. he is the creator of the Writing Better Action Through Cinematic Techniques Workshop, which is very intriguing to me, which helps writers to improve their action scenes. And he created the longest-running superhero webcomic done in Lego. I will take your word for that. The Adventures of the S-Team, which ran from 2006 through 2012. He just released the third novel in his well-received superhero fiction series, The Just Cause Universe. The book is Day of the Destroyer and is on sale now. Ian, I'm really happy to have you aboard. We've sort of known each other on the internet for a while now. We work in similar areas, though I think there's some overlap, maybe some differences, and we'll kind of explore that as we go along today. But usually the first thing that I ask guests is, how did you come to, you know, whatever the topic is? But I kind of have a two-part question for you to start us off today. One is, how did you first get into superheroes and superhero stories in general? And I'm imagining this will be an earlier answer, right? And then how did you get into writing novels about them?
Well, I've been a fan of superheroes for just about as long as I can remember. I mean, I remember as a kid, you know, never missing an episode of the Super Friends or Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends cartoons. The very first comic book I ever owned, I still remember, was a DC publication called Captain Carrot and His Amazing Zoo Crew, which was a funny animal comic that was kind of a send-up and spoof of more traditional and mainstream superhero comics. And I still have that, actually. It's number 14, and I read it until it just about fell apart, but I think that's really what set me off onto the path of, you know, loving superheroes and everything about them. And then as I got older and discovered role-playing games, I played a lot of GURPS supers with friends, and you know, that kind of led me into the creation of the Just Cause universe. So it started out as a gaming background. I've read the Wild Cards superhero novels edited by George R. R. Martin, and mm-hmm. I discovered those in the library in probably junior high school, and that just kind of blew my mind. Here was somebody who was writing about superheroes in books instead of in, you know, comics. So that was something that was it kind of planted the seeds that maybe I could do that someday. And then mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I remember those when they came out, and thinking how interesting it was. That was probably the first time I ever saw it was probably the first time I ever saw superheroes done as prose fiction. I think that it was the Marvel novel and anthology series that came out probably around 1978-79 was the first time that I ever saw superheroes in prose. Have you ever seen any of those books?
I have not, actually.
And then, of course, they've done later ones, you know. In fact, Keith DeCandido, who's, I think, going to be a guest of ours in a couple of weeks, he edited the Byron Price line for a while. So, they've been kind of that tradition of Marvel doing, and DC, too, doing superheroes as novels. But I think it's interesting that you mentioned the Wild Cards, just because they were the only ones really out there that were not affiliated with a pre-existing universe.
Right, they built theirs from scratch, and mm-hmm. actually, if you're familiar with the background of those novels, they began as a gaming group as well.
Yeah, that's right. And I was going to comment on that too, is that you said you kind of started out part of it as from role-playing game stuff, and that's kind of how my Sentinels did in a way. Because I was never a huge gamer myself per se, but my original plotting partner, who's an occasional co-host on here, Bobby Polite, he and I... he had some characters he had specifically done for a role-playing group, and so when he brought his gaming characters in with my sort of writing characters I was working on, that's kind of how we formed the original universe that the Sentinels came out of. So it's interesting, isn't it, how role-playing games just sort of always kind of have their DNA somewhere in the mix of this kind of thing.
I think they're wonderful tools for bringing out creativity and mm-hmm. exploring things that you might not think about, because it brings out so many different perspectives from different players and different game masters and so on.
Yeah, and it also kind of provides people who aren't interested in publishing their work or that don't have an audience, it gives them kind of a little feedback audience, because you're having to present it every time you play. You're having to take this intellectual property you've created and present it to this group of people who are basically your peers. And you are basically judged, right? I mean, they're going to tell you, well, that's lame, or that's good, or I like that, or that's really cool, or that's kind of stupid. And so you can kind of hone your early character and world-building skills with an RPG group before kind of rolling it out maybe later on, if you are so inclined, to a broader audience. So, yeah, I really do find it fascinating. I'm going to have to do a show on just role-playing games at some point, because that came up with Bobby, and it came up with you, obviously, and it's just kind of interesting to me how something that really is a different, it's not even a different genre, it's a different endeavor.
Yeah.
Well, it's not even, I mean, a different media would be like a movie versus a novel versus a short story. This is like gardening versus building construction. It's two completely different endeavors, and yet they share that same sort of DNA and that same bond. It just is really interesting to me. At some point, you had to say to yourself, I think we all did in this little game, you had to say to yourself, I've got these characters, I've got these ideas, I want to make stories out of them to entertain maybe myself and maybe other people. But at some point, you had to decide to do it as prose, as novels or short stories or whatever. So I'm curious now, what was kind of the impetus, if you can, I mean, maybe you don't even remember or don't even know, maybe there was no one specific thing, but what kind of pushed you to turn it into novels?
Well, I started out after college and during college, I had decided that I really wanted to be a comic book artist. Mm-hmm. Hmm. And so I discovered fairly quickly that I could not draw. And so that ended up going by the wayside, and I thought, well, maybe maybe I should try writing. I've always enjoyed writing. This was at the time when the Star Wars Expanded Universe was very big, and the Timothy Zahn novels had come out, and they were pumping them out very quickly from Delray Books. And I decided, well, you know what? Here's what I'll do. I've always kind of wanted to write a Star Wars book, so I'm going to do that, and I'll send it to Delray, and they'll publish it, and I'll become famous, and then I'll be able to write whatever I want. See, I had it all worked out.
Sure.
So this was way back in about 2002 or so, and I wrote out the superhero. I wrote out the Star Wars book and sent an email off to the editor at the time of Delray Books, who was in charge of the Star Wars line, and she did not have to reply to me, but she did and said, "You know, we're sorry, we don't accept unsolicited submissions." And I replied and asked, "Well, what is it that I would need to do to become solicited for that?"
Mm-hmm.
And again, she didn't have to respond to me, but she replied and said, "Well, you need to be, you know, writing of a certain style that appeals to the Star Wars audience. You need to be popular in the field, and you know, a few other things." And a lot of people might have taken that and walked away and said, "You know, that's just not. I'm not going to get away with that. I can't do that." But I just took it as a challenge. Said, "Okay, fine." So over the next several months, I wrote out the book, which has since become the novel Just Cause. And that really was what set me off on this path.
So you did the beginning of your Just Cause universe before anything else, sort of professionally.
Right. This was, as I said, this would have been back in 2003, 2004, thereabouts, is when I wrote that. And the original book was this, you know, 110,000 word behemoth that was, quite frankly, very bad. And it took several years for me to become good enough at the art of writing that I could actually take it after I'd gotten some 140 rejections from pretty much every agent out there, and I could open it up and say, "This is crap," and I cut about 60,000 words out of it and replaced it with about 40,000 new words and edited it again and again, and now that final product is what's out on the market.
And that's what it takes. I mean, that's what you have to do, is you always learn and you always grow and you always figure out, you know, what's how to do things better. Let me ask you this then, because one thing that's always kind of concerned me the last couple of years is that the first novel I ever actually had professionally published I was writing as early as, you know, well, we talked about this on the previous show, several, me and a couple of the guys, but it's like, you know, kindergarten. But the first one I actually got published was in 2008, the first Sentinels novel, When Strikes the Warlord. And, you know, looking back now, I worry that it's, I mean, I feel that it's a strong book and lots of people have read it and liked it, but I just always worry, you know, I just can't be still. I always think I should go back and rewrite it using the tools I've learned this year as opposed to last year or the year before, you know? And
right.
So are you happy to just let it go out there and float away? Or does it still kind of bother you that maybe you could make it a little better? Maybe you could, and I don't mean that specifically of you. I'm just curious what you think about that phenomenon, because it bothers me about my books.
You know, it is something that, you know, it's like being a parent.
Yeah.
You know, at some point you just have to be willing to let it go and say, you know, this is it, and I may be better now, but I'm not going to keep going back and messing with it, or I'm never going to have the time to do something new, because I'm always going to be going back to try and fix things on my older work.
Yeah.
I understand now why so many actors refuse to watch movies that they've been in, because they just don't want to see themselves at an earlier point in their careers when they may not have been as good as they are currently.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. That really does. Well, all right. Well, okay, so let's get more specifically into your stuff now. What you've talked a little bit about your books so far, but how would you describe them overall? I mean, how would you describe what you're trying to do either with your specific, you know, series or with your overall approach?
Well, I mean, I love, you know, all kinds of speculative fiction. I mean, really all fiction is speculative, but I appreciate the, you know, the more out there branches, the science fiction, the fantasy, and the superhero specifically has been something that's just appealed to me right from the start. With the Just Cause novels, the Just Cause universe, what I wanted to do is to create kind of a comprehensive background in which I could tell stories about, you know, essentially any character or team that would stand up on their own as well as part of the larger universe. In a sense, it's like what the comic book publishers do, or like the Star Wars expanded universe, where they've created this big detailed setting that stories can come from anywhere and go anywhere and focus on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the each Just Cause novel is a self-contained story. I mean, you could pick up any of the three of them right now and read it and not be lost wondering, you know, what did I miss in a different book? You know, that's something I've really focused on. I want to tell a complete story instead of just part of an overall greater arc. You know, if I'm going to tell a big arc, it's all going to be in one novel.
That's interesting. Okay, that's kind of the opposite of my approach. You know, the way that I've been doing them is to have trilogies, and I'll use the first book to kind of introduce the situation, and there's usually sort of a resolution, but sort of a bigger story that's brewing, and then the second book has all the complications and ramping everything up, and everything looks dire and horrible, and then the third book is kind of the big finish. But then what I've been doing is when all three are done, combining them into an omnibus of all three, which gives you like a 700-page monster of that whole story. So if you're able to tell an entire story in one book, then do you feel like you're telling a smaller story maybe than some, or are you more compact with how you write it, or how do you feel like you're able to get an entire story into just one regular sized book is what I'm getting at?
Well, like with the first two books, you know, Just Cause and the Archmage, you know, they both feature the main character of Mustang Sally, and you know, as her role on the team Just Cause, and you know, you sort of, that goes from the first book to the second, you know, where it looks at her growth and development at, you know, from an 18-year-old rookie to, you know, becoming a more valued and experienced member of the team. There's her personal relationships with you know, her boyfriend and with the other members of the team, and so there is an arc in that sense. But I tend to think more like you know, if you would have an arc in comic books that might, you know, like a storyline like the death of the family, which was a recent one in the Batman books. That you know, it has a beginning and it has an end. It develops some things that are part of the overall characters and that, you know, the whole universe. But it is a sort of a definite beginning and end of a specific storyline, and that's kind of how I'm approaching the Just Cause novels.
Well, that's kind of interesting. You and I both start out with a young female character who's kind of the novice, who's learning the ropes, and we both follow how she evolves and learns and grows. from the ones I've read of yours, I get the sense that you are as much interested in kind of her life and her relationships and everything, and kind of digging around that a little bit, which is terrific. Whereas you see that stuff in passing in mine, but they're usually more kind of plot focused on the menace or whatever, and so you kind of see that stuff kind of in the background. Is was there a conscious decision that you made to kind of focus your character more that way, if I'm even correct, or is it just kind of the organically the way that you write, do you think?
I think it's a lot of it's just sort of an organic way that I write. You know, Mustang Sally's story really is part of the larger universe. I mean, I set her up where she is the first of the third generation superheroes in the Just Cause universe, where her mother was one of the powerhouses of the team in the 70s and 80s. And in fact, Day of the Destroyer, her mother is one of the main characters set during 1977. And then her grandmother was one of the World War II veteran heroes. So I'm almost following the DC Universe organization, where you had the All-Star Squadron of the 1940s, and then you had the Silver Age characters of the 60s and 70s, and then there's the Modern Age. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of done that with the Just Cause universe.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's really cool. I like, and it's good because it lets you lay down such a kind of a multi-layered background and history and texture to it that gives it depth and resonance, I think. And I like that approach very much. I've most of my characters have just kind of appeared, and there's a sense that there was stuff before it, but I've been holding that out as kind of a mystery that's only revealed slowly. So I hope that approach works as well as yours. I might should have given the reader more information up front, but I've been kind of parsing it out very slowly.
Yeah, I haven't been disappointed in what I've read from the Sentinels, so you know, I'm sure your readers aren't either.
Yeah, just different ways of going about it, I guess, but that's cool. And, of course, we both can give a – well, let's see. So when did just – you say Just Cause about 2002, 2003 probably?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because see, Jolt, Kurt Busiek introduced Jolt in about 97 or 98, and Bobby and I were losing our minds because we had introduced Pulsar originally in 95, 96, and we felt like this is our character almost that's just suddenly appeared in mainstream Marvel Comics. And there's nothing new, right? I mean, I've always said if you don't write something in a hurry, three other people are going to do it before you finish typing it. So it's just the way of the world, I think. Have you had that
anymore,
happen with any of your
characters?
Have you had that happen with any of your characters where you've had them and suddenly you've seen almost the same thing appear in a more mainstream work?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, I think especially with the superhero genre, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of us who all have kind of the same background.
Yeah.
And that is colored the way that we create our characters in a lot of ways. And, you know, when you're writing superheroes, there's certain tropes that you're going to have in your book, and pretty much, you know, regardless. I mean, you know, you've got sort of the prototypical battlesuit character, mm-hmm. or you've got the muscle man, or the super speedster. I mean, Mustang Sally, she's a speedster, and her costume is red because I think speedsters should have red costumes.
Well, yeah, definitely needs to be a warmer color. I agree. You wouldn't want a speedster in like dark blue or something. That just doesn't make a lot of sense. I agree.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. I'm trying to figure out how to approach this because we've touched on some of this already. Is there anything else about your characters that's sort of unique that you'd want the audience to know that they really need to check out? You know, in other words, what are you doing that you'd say this is something that's really cool about it that you need to take a look at?
Well, I think one of the most important things for any writer is to not make your characters into Mary Sues.
Hmm.
And for those listeners who don't know what that is, a Mary Sue is essentially a perfect character who never fails and is good at everything and is incredibly boring, really.
Mm-hmm.
And I always try and put in real effort to make my characters flawed and human and make mistakes and you know, I mean, Sally, for example, she's very skilled with her powers. She's been, you know, she was trained by her grandmother and her mother from an early age, but she hasn't had a chance to, you know, she didn't get to sort of be a kid. She didn't get to go out and play with other kids because she was being trained, kind of like the Silk Spectre in Watchmen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she hasn't had a lot of life experience that didn't involve superhero stuff in some way. So that's been, you know, something that she's had to learn how to do, to deal with people on a more of a personal instead of a powers-based level.
Right. And by the way, you mentioned Mary Sue. The reason that Mary Sue characters are the way that you describe them, of course, is because they are basically supposed to be the author inserting him or herself into the story and therefore making him or herself perfect, right? Mm-hmm. So there's sort of a double level to it. It's a character that's not only too good to be true for a story because, like, you know, because stories are about conflict and imperfection and improvement and transformation, but also because it's making yourself into a character, which is never a good idea, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't look good in tights.
I agree. Yeah, me too. I say the same thing. So how often do you put a new Just Cause book out? Is there a sort of a fixed schedule?
I've got right now two more completed books in the wings that I'm planning to release about 6 months apart because my plan is that, you know, with the amount that I write, I should be able to release to write a new Just Cause novel at least once a year, and by doing that and releasing them 6 months apart, I've given myself a bit of a cushion for, you know, releasing them ahead of time. So, in this coming fall will be a novel called Deep Six, which focuses on the prison where convicted, parahuman offenders are placed. And then in, spring of next year will be Jackrabbit, which, is about that rabbit themed religious powered superhero that you mentioned in my introduction.
So you've got kind of a backlog then. You can put them out whenever you want.
That's my plan.
So did you just not publish anything for a while and just write a bunch of stuff? Or how did you get ahead of yourself like that? I'm curious. I'm very curious.
Well, really, I didn't start with publishing my stuff until the very beginning of 2011.
Oh, okay.
And at that point, I already had a backlog of several NaNoWriMo books, which I had revised and edited, and I had the Just Cause books, which I had revised and edited. So I think when I started publishing, that I probably had 8 novels, maybe, at the time, ready, 8 to 10.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I didn't want to release them so much, just put this huge glut of my stuff on the market that would kind of fatigue people, say, oh, look, there's more stuff. This guy has got so much stuff, there's no way I can ever get through it. So I'm trying to pace myself to, you know, to keep people coming back regularly, but not have all this work released at once and then nothing for, you know, several months.
Yeah, I think that's probably a very good idea, the way you approached it. I've been kind of having to write frantically because I've started about 3 or 4 series because I really feel strongly that series are the way to go. Readers like it.
Yes.
And they like, you know, and you've already done the work once, so you don't have to do all the world building completely from scratch again, although I keep doing different series, so I have been doing it again. but I had to kind of write frantically to keep each of the plates spinning, you know, because the Sentinel series started in 2008 from Permuted, and then the Lucian series, I can't even really call it a series yet, came out in 2009 from Airship 27, and then Hawk from White Rocket in 2011. And now the new Shattering series with Lords of Fire. And so that's 4 different, 3 of which are kind of interrelated, but I've committed to putting out a new Sentinels book every year, and I've got a pretty sizable, I guess, you know, for small press, base of readers of Sentinels. So I've got to put a Sentinels book out every year. But then that leaves me, you know, the other half of the year to do three other books. It's tough.
Quite frankly, you astonish me at your output. Well, I mean, people tell me that I write a lot, but I kind of think I don't hold a candle to what you're putting out there right now.
Well, so. I don't know. It's a lot of it is just frantic panic, you know, trying to keep. And then there's all the publishers that are soliciting short stories, and I usually feel obligated to do at least one or two of those a year, which is something I was going to ask you too. Have you done any of those yet, or do you have any interest in you know, doing like the anthology stuff that a lot of the small publishers in our field have been doing lately?
Well, I have done some short story stuff. In fact, I think you and I appeared in a Thousand Faces,
yes,
together, and that was a few years ago. And I find that I really prefer writing the long form, mm-hmm, fiction works. I can and I do write short stories, and I have probably, you know, a dozen, 15 of them out for sale right now, including several from the Just Cause universe, which I've done to help sort of expand and create interest. I've got some freebies out there as well. Mm. But by and large, I prefer writing the long form stuff.
Well, yeah, I'm the same way. I like the big epics with tons of characters and all that. And it goes on for many, many pages. I've always been that way. I guess I've done stuff for Airship and for Prose and others, in part because it's, you know, publicity and finding new readers and everything, which has certainly been the case. But also it kind of forces you to stretch into other areas. Like, because I've written stuff for Airship and Prose, among others, I've had to write about, you know, 1930s kind of pulp stuff. I've had to write about airplane pilot characters like Lance Starr for Bobby Nash, and doing stuff like that. The monster thing for Jim Beard this past year, the Monster Hunters, Monster Aces. It just lets you stretch a little bit. So I would recommend maybe once a year try to get in on one of those, maybe just to kind of give yourself a little. It's almost like you use different muscles, you know, a little bit. So, mm-hmm, and you meet some new readers too. So it's. But yeah, I agree with you. It's not my favorite thing to do. With no offense to all the people out there that have been reading them, but we do live in a time now when there are several small press publishers that are putting out these anthologies. And it's not a bad thing to jump on and while the getting is good. In fact, this is really sort of the golden age of small press, I would argue, in a lot of ways.
Yes, I definitely agree with that. And any of the anthology publishers that are listening, you know, feel free to get in touch with me. And I've actually done a lot of experimenting with genres. I've got an extremely popular that it surprised me to no end how popular it is. It's called The Mighty Peculiar Incident at Muddy Creek. It's a free short story, a sort of a steampunk Western, science fiction Western. This week it's been hovering between number 5 and number 7 on the top 100 free short stories list on Amazon.
Awesome.
And I'm astonished at how popular it's become. And I have got a collection of stories sort of set around this small town in the Wild West where odd things and steampunky and there's some magic and things like that are going on. And, you know, that is something where the short stories has been something I've had a lot of fun with, just writing these sort of little vignettes about people in this town and then combining them into a collection.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. And I think that's a good idea, too, is to have something out there that's free that lets people kind of sample your work, see your name, try it out, and then maybe then if they're interested, they can just jump right on over to you know, your actual series and everything. I think that's a very, very good idea. I'm going to have to just make a note here to steal this idea from Ian. Okay, got it. if people are looking for your stuff, by the way, what's the main imprint that we find you under?
My stuff is published under the imprint of Local Hero Press.
Local Hero Press. That's right. I couldn't remember. I'm sorry.
Yes, it's me. I mean, that's that is Local Hero Press.
Sure.
But the reason I decided to do it as an imprint is sort of looking ahead to the future. You know, in the event that you know, my stuff is wildly successful and I have, you know, discretionary funding to possibly, you know, publish an anthology of my own with being able to pay other authors. Cause that, I think that's something that's very important. If you're going to be a publisher, you've got to pay authors for their work.
Oh, sure. And,
you know, if I'm going to do something like that, I want to do it under an imprint instead of under my own name.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mailed out a whole box full of checks January 1st. I know what you mean. They weren't huge cause this is small press, but I did mail out quite a box full. And then ate peanut butter sandwiches for the rest of January. Let me see. So, getting back into kind of the nuts and bolts of what you write and what I write, and I'm finding it interesting to kind of compare and contrast as we go along here. Obviously, doing superheroes as in prose fiction, as words instead of pictures and words. And by the way, that reminded me, I was going to say earlier, you were talking about discovering you couldn't draw and everything. And I think a lot of us writers who were influenced by comics had that moment, right? I grew up, you know, one of the first things I read growing up as a kid was Jim Starlin's Metamorphosis Odyssey as it was coming out in Epic Magazine. And it just, that combined everything I loved. I mean, and I didn't know I loved it yet. You know, that was when I was probably 10, you know, or 9 or something. But it was cosmic, far outer space, galactic warfare. But it also had that kind of a superhero element to it because it was Jim Starlin, you know, all the stuff that Starlin brought to the table. And I just wanted to grow up and be Jim Starlin or John Byrne, one of these people that could write and draw a big epic story completely by themselves. And of course, you know, kind of like you, what I discovered was that I really couldn't draw it very well. I even got as far as drawing class at Auburn freshman year and realized, you know, I have enormous respect for artists. In fact, I was telling one of them at Windy City Con a couple of years ago, I said, "You guys are sorcerers. It's got to be magic involved somehow because there's no little spark when I do it. I mean, I can draw little animals from my daughter or something like that, but I can't draw anything that would be considered professional, you know, comics work." And so I said, you signed a deal with the devil on the crossroads at midnight or something that gave you this magical power to draw cool stuff better than normal people. And it drives me crazy because it's almost like they have a magical power that you have to go to as a publisher or a writer if you want art for your stuff. I have to go to them and say, "Oh, magical sorcerer, artist person, please use your magic powers to create something for me that I could never create, even though I could write a darn good book for it, you know?
Bestow your gifts upon me."
Yes, yeah, yeah. So it's kind of depressing in a way. maybe a lot of us writers are just failed, frustrated artists who are trying to find another way to express ourselves.
Well, I've been incredibly fortunate to befriend Jeff Hebert, the creator of the Hero Machine. Mm-hmm. It's a Flash application, and HeroMachine.com. I'm going to give him a plug here, and it's a wonderful tool for visualizing characters and creating them. It's and he's a friend of mine. He lives here in Colorado, and some of the time he divides his time between here and Texas. And he's done the art for both the Just Cause and Day of the Destroyer covers. And his Day of the Destroyer cover is just blew me away.
Awesome.
It was just amazing.
Awesome. Well, very cool. Yeah, I had to find several artists. I mean, I'm very, very fortunate to have Chris Kohler doing my interiors, and he did the cover for Metal God. So, yeah, when you can find somebody that you can work with and is dependable and you like their style and everything, man, that's a treasure. You got to hang on to it.
Absolutely.
So what I was trying to get at before I redirected myself was, what would you see as sort of the benefits of doing superhero stories in prose rather than as comics?
Well, I think the benefit is that it does make it more accessible for a mainstream reader. I mean, with the ebook readers, I mean, there's more people that are, you know, able to read comics on a regular basis because, I mean, Marvel makes them available and DC does, and I'm sure there's other publishers as well. But by and large, most adults mainstream aren't going to pick up a comic book and start reading it, or they're going to be sort of daunted by the amount of history. I mean, you've got, you know, 80 years of Batman, and, you know, that's kind of scary for a new reader to pick something up and say, well, where do I start? So the benefits of writing these as books, and especially as self-contained tales, is that it makes them accessible to more of a mainstream reader, especially someone who, you know, is interested in a good story but might not want to pick up a graphic novel or a comic book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually, it's funny, isn't it? Because I've had reviewers say, you know, about the Sentinels books, well, you, once you get past number one, you couldn't just pick this up and read it. You got to go back to the beginning. And I'm thinking, well, I didn't start with Avengers number one. I started with Avengers 162. You figure stuff out, you know? I mean, come on. I think it's sort of disingenuous about one medium versus another, one sub, you know, sub medium. But when you're actually writing the story, okay, when you're actually creating the story in prose, do you feel like there are opportunities for you as the writer that are different and better than if you were doing it as a script for an artist to draw?
I do, because you know, when you're doing a comic book and you've got, you know, you've got that artist's impression of what the writer of the storyline wanted, and that's what you have. It's in front of you. It's concrete thing. Whereas when I'm writing in prose, it does leave certain aspects up to the reader's imagination to sort of fill in those blanks. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I can describe Sally as, you know, she's small and slender and has a red costume with yellow trim and long blonde braids. But what does she really look like? You know, she's going to look different in the mind of every reader. Mm-hmm. And so I think that writing in prose helps to engage a reader on a different level, you know, bring some of their own imagination out. Whereas, you know, reading comics does less of providing that sort of that visual thing, that visual look, because it's already there.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I guess for me, the thing that struck me, and I've asked the other guests on this topic before, but I keep thinking about it more and more. And what I think what's emerging in my mind now is more that I like the idea that when you write in prose, you can convey subtleties easier. It's very difficult in comics to convey subtle things. Comics are very good at in-your-face things. But subtleties are harder. And I give you as an example, Brian Bendis. Bendis writes like he's writing a movie script, which is fine and dandy, except that he then puts an enormous burden on his artist to be able to convey, you know, subtle meanings in only a couple of panels. And I think that really for comics to be able to convey very subtle messages takes a number of pages or panels, because you have to show people's expressions. You have to show their expression changing. You have to show them looking from one person to another as they think about something. It almost takes
thought balloons.
Yeah. Thought balloons used to do that, but comics have gotten more sophisticated, quote unquote. And so you can't just overtly say stuff in a thought balloon anymore. You have to kind of show it like it's in a movie, where you see a character going, oh, I just changed my mind about something, you know. And that kind of thing actually takes longer than an action scene in some, you know, in some cases in a comic. So in a novel, you can just have that internal monologue going on right there on the page.
Yeah, writing a conversation for a comic book would, you know, cause a lot of readers to set it aside and say, this is just boring because there's nothing to see here. It's just two people talking. But a conversation in prose can be, you know, incredibly important and can really draw in a reader. So
yeah,
I think it's the difference just between a visual, a primarily visual and a primarily imaginative medium.
Yeah.
If I might make that comparison.
I think that's a very good way to put it. So, obviously, all writers have different strengths. What do you feel like is your real primary strength as a writer, and how do you use it in your books?
Well, I've been I've been told that I've got a very good sense of dialogue mm-hmm. and sort of creating that realistic sounding dialogue. And I don't think there's any great trick to doing that. I mean, it's just a matter of, you know, having people talk the way people actually talk.
Right.
And, you know, when you do that, it makes the characters seem more accessible. But I think by and large, my greatest strength would probably be in creating vivid and detailed yet accessible action scenes.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I was getting compliments on from the very earliest days of my writing. And that would probably lead into me developing this workshop and accompanying book that I put together for it.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Well, it really came about as, you know, with a couple of my beta readers that would, they'd read my stuff and they would just keep coming back saying, you know, these action scenes are fantastic. And, can you help me with writing my action scene and how do you do it? And I finally had to sit down one day and say, well, you know what, how do I write an action scene?
Yeah.
Because it's just something I do. And after really thinking about it, I discovered that, a lot of it has to come back to my love of movies. And when I write an action scene, I think of it in terms of a movie and how would I as a director, you know, shoot a particular sequence, whether it's, a chase or a fight or a shootout or what have you. And that's what led to me putting together this little workshop called Writing Better Action Scenes Through Cinematic Techniques.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of how you break down an action scene, you know, into its essential elements of, you know, a stunt is sort of, you know, a simple individual act, you know, and it's the building block of a scene is the stunt. And, you know, several stunts chained together form a sequence.
Mm-hmm. So
that's just sort of how I developed it.
And you do like a seminar for this, or
I have a seminar I've put on a couple times for local writers groups.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a blog called Writing Better Action, or it's Write Better Action, that's associated with the book, and I'll actually review action scenes if people want to send them to me, and I outline all that on the blog. And it will, but ultimately it's just, it's a 99 cent ebook or mm-hmm. a $7.99 print book that you can, get and, just use it as a reference for writing.
That's cool. If any of the writers track, folks at Dragon Con are listening, I don't know them like I know the literary track. There's a literary track and there's a writer's track. But if the writer's track folks are listening, you need to get Ian down to have a panel on this, because I think this is something that people would find very interesting. I would love to be in on that. That just sounds very cool. I like the idea of picking a specific thing that in our particular type of literature in particular, you know, you have to kind of be good at and kind of focusing on that and honing that. I kind of like you. I've spent time thinking about, you know, I've been told that I do good action scenes, but I've never really been able to figure out. I guess for me, a big part of it is focus. I like to think that that you can't just be all over the map. You can have a whole lot of action going on in a scene, but you kind of have to focus on one thing at a time, because you'll get things will get fuzzy if you try to tell too much at once. You know, in other words, try to focus on what Pulsar is doing and then leave her at a certain point. Focus on what's happening with Ezra, leave him at a certain point. You just kind of have to be deliberate and disciplined and focused is kind of how I feel. Does that sound like it meshes up with your methods?
Yeah, very much so. It's you know, it's creating the scene like you have a camera
mm-hmm.
and you don't want to take the Michael Bay, you know, half second jump cut approach to writing an action scene. It has to flow. You know, if you look at, you know, something like, I don't know, like one of the the fights from the Transformers movies, which I can't stand, compared to, you know, a smooth, detailed, exciting sequence like you have the chase in the movie Ronin with Robert De Niro, the car chase through the streets of Paris. It's an amazing scene. You know, I would love to write something with that type of flow to it. And, you know, I hope it that in at least one of my books, perhaps, that I have.
Yeah, I think that clarity, focus and clarity. I mean, you can you provide the illusion of chaos, but there has to be an underlying, you know, web of clarity and focus so that there. I think my favorite example actually in a comic book of how somebody completely didn't understand this was when Rob Liefeld was doing the Avengers back in Heroes Reborn, because on one page you got Captain America giving orders to the team, you know, like Avengers execute plan 3057A now. And on the next page, it's a two-page spread of just chaos. You know, just everybody's jumping and running and shooting and all. And I'm thinking, this was plan number 3,000, whatever.
I mean, right.
For everybody to just...
What were the others?
Yeah, exactly. They run at a slightly different angle or a little slower. Or, I mean, you know, what... So that was an... I think that's an example of how you can be so caught up in the idea of a big action scene that the person loses focus on making it clear to the reader why each thing individually matters.
Right. And a big action scene can be extremely daunting task for a writer. I have probably the biggest battle I've ever written is in the climax of the Just Cause novel, you know, and it's some 50 odd superheroes against a small army. And, you know, it's trying to make sense of that and still keep it flowing and still keeping it focused on the central narrative character. I mean, it's a very challenging task.
Well, you pulled it off very well, though. Yeah, and that's why I think that you definitely are an authority to speak on this, which is one of the reasons I had you on. But one thing I'm curious about, I mentioned this to you, I think, previously, that As I've been doing these books, I find that I'm doing less and less of the big graphic action scene. Now, that may be just antithetical to you because you actually teach how to do a big action scene, and that's great. But am I just getting burned out on them, or am I finding it more interesting to do other things? I'm kind of wondering myself, why is it that I've put in, because in the last couple of books, I've kind of minimized the battle, the sort of the nitty gritty detail of the battle in favor of maybe the larger context or the characters or whatever. I don't know. Is that something that strikes any kind of a chord with you or not?
Well, you know, I've written books where the actual action was minimal and, I think one that stands out in particular is Hope and Undead Elvis, which is sort of my reinterpretation of the story of Mary, Mother of Jesus, in a post-apocalyptic setting. But surprisingly, for a post-apocalyptic novel, there is almost no action in it at all. But there is a tremendous amount of conflict. And ultimately, as storytellers, we're dealing in conflict. And there's many ways to address and to resolve conflict in fiction, and an action scene, you know, is only one tool. And obviously, it's one of my favorites, and I do like to use them, but it should not be the only tool in our toolbox for resolving conflict. And if you're choosing to resolve your conflict in other ways, that is completely fine. I mean, there's no need certainly to beat yourself up and say, well, you know, I gotta have a fist fight here. there's just nothing going on. I gotta have somebody shoot somebody. Well, no, you don't, if there's other ways to resolve the conflict without it.
Well, as long,
even in real life, violence should be a last resort.
Well, that's true. I guess I just worry that my readers are going to be disappointed if I don't have as much intimate detail on every blow by blow of every fight scene, you know, going forward. I don't find it quite as interesting as I did before. I guess it's almost like a spice that you don't want too much to, it'll overpower the rest of the soup. You know, you need to use it judiciously, I guess, like, which is kind of what you were saying. So,
sure.
So, well, okay. I'll quit worrying quite so much about it then. So, my last question kind of about your writing and so forth before we kind of move toward our final segment. Where do you see your writing evolving in the future? Do you see Just Cause novels and this sort of thing into the infinite future, or do you feel like that your writing is growing in different ways, maybe that you didn't expect, that might lead you into some other things? Maybe from where you stand right now, where does the future look?
Well, I definitely have many more Just Cause Universe novels in mind. And I don't see that I'm going to stop writing them unless and then from readership just completely dies out. But I'm also experimenting a lot with other areas and topics and genres. I've been writing more young adult stuff recently. Mm. I actually have an agent who represents just my young adult work. Mm. You know, the last couple of novels that I've sent to her have not involved any type of superpowers or science fiction or anything speculative at all. You know, one of them set in a small high school in Texas, and the other one focuses around a cooking competition for teenagers. So that's been an area that I've been exploring more and will probably continue to do so. I've been exploring fantasy and westerns. I just completed the sequel to my fantasy western novel Pariah's Moon. I just finished the first draft actually last night.
Oh.
And that one should eventually be a trilogy if there's enough interest for me to finish the third book. Mm. I have space operas on tap. I've got more fantasy. It's just I don't want to tie myself down to a single genre. I mean, I'd love to be known specifically for the superhero stuff. You know, Ian Thomas Healy, oh, he's that superhero guy. He writes great superhero stories. But, you know, that's only about half of what I've released.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to keep expanding my interests. I'd love to write a murder mystery someday, and I probably will.
Yeah.
It's just, I don't need to pigeonhole myself into a genre, especially when I am controlling, you know, ultimately what I'm releasing through my own imprint.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. As we kind of move toward our last couple of minutes, I wanted to get your thoughts about sort of the marketplace in general. Your books that come from Local Hero have both paperback and ebook versions, right?
Yes.
Right. And which does better, if I may ask, for Local Hero? Which tends to do better, the print book or ebook? And I ask this not to pry into your business's business, but simply because it's been a conversation in the new pulp world for about a year and a half, 2 years now, that it seemed like everybody got a Kindle for Christmas in December of 2011, and by January of 2012, we were all sort of noticing some movement in our sales numbers. And so I'm just kind of curious how you have reacted to that, how that's happened to you.
Well, I don't disagree with that. My 2012 ebook sales just took off mm-hmm. like a rocket, especially in the second half of the year. And I hit some numbers that, you know, where every month I was coming back with, you know, higher sales figures than I had the month previously. And it was just like, this is just amazing. You know, when is it going to peak? Ebooks, I think, are definitely the direction that things are going in the future. I'm only going to release print editions of the Just Cause Universe stuff for the foreseeable future, unless I really see a lot of demand for other books in print. And even then, I would do it through print-on-demand because of the expense associated with it.
Well, sure. Yeah, that's the way to go. Absolutely. Well, what do you think about pricing on ebooks? I don't necessarily mean yours in particular, but just in general. This is another conversation we've been having kind of in the New Pulp world is some people will – and I've been doing kind of a poll informally in different venues, and about half the people say if the price is too low, I won't even touch it because it must be bad. The other half of the people will say, oh, no, if it's that cheap, I'll get it because it doesn't really represent too much of an investment, even if it's bad. And then the same people will turn around and say, well, if it's more than $4 or $5, I won't get it because it's an ebook. It shouldn't cost that much. And others will say, well, if it's $4 or $5, it must be good, so I'm more likely to get it. So I'm kind of pulling my hair out because I'm getting totally contradictory marketplace data back. So how do you see that?
Well, buckle up. because that's going to continue.
Yeah.
There's validity to both sides of that argument. I think that generally the the big six publishers are overpricing their ebooks, and you know it's fairly obvious that the reason they're doing that, and that is ultimately it's hurting the authors more than it's hurting anybody because the authors, you know, if they're only making a 25% of net and then Amazon is discounting a $9.99 ebook, you know, the authors, you know, suddenly making less than a dollar in royalties.
Right.
And, you know, that really hurts the author. Whereas, you know, if you're publishing on your own, you know, the way I am, you know, with a $3.99 price point for a novel, you know, it's $3 and change royalties, and you know, so I can sell one of my books for, you know, $4 compare and make three times the royalty of someone who's selling one for $10.
Yeah.
So you know, am I undervaluing my work? I don't think so. Because ultimately I want people to buy it. I want to get my words in front of people and I need to make that, you know, an attractive price point. And still, you know, at the end of the day, you know, have a buck or two to take home and buy a cup of coffee.
Right.
So it is a tricky balancing point with pricing and, you know, I don't think there's a right answer. You know, are you undervaluing your work? Is it lower quality because of a low price point? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, does it being expensive mean that it must be good? Not necessarily. Mm-hmm. You know, it all comes down to what your readers are willing to spend and what the market will bear.
I think you're totally right. I think that we're going to just continue to see this story play out, really, and we'll see if kind of a consensus develops. But right now, I think that around $2.99 to $3.99 seems to be kind of the sweet spot for an ebook that's not from like Random House, you know, or Del Rey or something. So, and if you are, like you say, kind of a one man or two person operation, you're not having to get just a tiny fraction of that money. I've told the story that we sold Blackthorn, the anthology from White Rocket. We sold it for about a week for 99 cents, just to kind of drum up interest. And, you know, we sold a certain number of copies, but we were getting 33 cents a copy divided by 12 contributors. So we certainly weren't doing it for the money on that immediate, you know, we were looking for the
right here. Here's your nickel. Enjoy your day.
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, that's another thing that has led me more and more to be kind of a one man operation on some of my books. I mean, I still do things for Airship and for Prose and for others, but for my own stuff, I really want to do as much of the stuff myself as I can, not because I'm selfish, just because there's not a lot of profit, you know, in publishing, period, unless you're really, you know, selling tons and tons of volume of books. And so I just would rather not have to divide it up among a whole bunch of people and each person get such a small amount that they're not very thrilled anyway. So, yeah, the more you can do yourself in this very, very small press field, I think the better. What, you know, the last thing I'll ask you then is about marketing. What are your thoughts on marketing something that's, you know, most of the stuff that you and I both do is fairly sub genre, though, like you said, you know, you are branching out in other areas, and I have too. But what are your general thoughts on kind of marketing this stuff?
Well, if anybody knows what works, give me a call.
Yeah.
I've tried a lot of different techniques. You know, I've hired a publicist in the past. I've done blog tours. I have done book signings, and really the one thing I've found that works best above anything else is to keep putting out quality work on a regular basis.
Yeah.
You know, and get that word of mouth, get the readers coming back for more.
Yeah. You know, and
I think at the end of the day, that's what works best for me.
Yeah. I agree with you completely. I think the one other thing that's helped a lot, though, is I've done a lot of convention touring the last 5 years or more. Actually, gosh, it's probably been more like 6 or 7 or 8 years now. But getting out and meeting readers and talking with them at your table and kind of telling them in panels or at, you know, one-on-one, you know, what it is you're trying to do and why they might enjoy it has been very effective to me. I've sold a lot more paperbacks that way. In fact, the omnibus books sell very well at conventions because people can look at all the little overpriced, you know, 200 page books that people have for sale. Then they'll come over and see my 700 page Sentinels omnibus with that Mitch Faust painted cover. And I'll say, yeah, you can get three whole books for just $20, and they snap it up. I sell out of that book every convention I do. So when they feel like they're getting something that's quality and kind of different and they're getting a whole lot for their money, but it's not taking them down to that point where they think it's too cheap. I think that really is kind of a marketing sweet spot that exists that you can exploit.
Mm-hmm.
So I recommend you hit some conventions. I would love to see you out on the road sometime. I think you would we could ally and try to reach the audience.
It'd be a big team up.
Yeah, that's what our genre is all about, right? Well, first we'd have to fight, but then we would team up.
Right, right. Yes.
We'd be throwing books to each other across the aisle, see? But then we'd see common cause and we'd team up, see? So.
Right, and then we have to take down the villain.
There you go.
So.
I like it. And of course, the villain would be Tommy Hancock. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I kid Tommy. No. let me see. So, all right. Well, I think we're pretty much to the end of our time here. I want to make sure that we get your information out to the listeners because I'm sure they've found this pretty darn interesting. Getting a different perspective on superhero prose from somebody who's done it for a while and is very accomplished at it. So tell the folks how they can find you in various places, including the Facebook and Twitters.
Sure. My Facebook is author Ian Thomas Healy. It's IanThomasHealy. I'm on Twitter at Ian T. Healy. And my website is www.enthealy.com, and that links to Local Hero Press as well as to my webcomic in case anybody wants to read through all 1,500 strips in the archives.
Okay, well, thanks so much. Ian, I really appreciate you being on today. It's about time for the rocket to get out of here for another week, but I think our third installment of Superheroes and Prose and Beyond has been a big success. Thanks a bunch for coming on, man.
Thanks for having me, Van. Appreciate it.
All right. We will see you later, Ian, and we will see the rest of you on down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek. Classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.